session number 9437, reel 7.
Elizabeth Hughes, tape 7.
Yes. General Shaoqi, who we referred to as the Chinless Wonder, was of course very emaciated because of this only being able to have a liquid diet. But nevertheless, Doug Clifford, the New Zealand doctor, thought he might be able to repair his jaw, his lips, with a pedicle graft, which entails lifting flesh up in one part of the body, and by a series of graftings, transfer it to another part of the body. I don't think it's used at all now, but at that time it was the best that could be done, and was used quite a lot. He became Doug Clifford's patient, and he did manage to do the first stage of the operation. I'm not sure whether it was then or a bit later, but anyway, he travelled with us and remained Doug's patient as long as the treatment was needed to continue, because it meant a lot of operations. He owned his own horse, which was a good thing, so he could travel slightly independently of people who had to be stretcher carried and so on. But I'll tell you, Doug got this pedicle like a handle on his chest and transferred it to, I think, straight up to his neck. And I know at one point when this pedicle was joining his face and his chest, we had to have a sudden move, and he had to ride his horse holding his head very steady so as not to pull on this graft.
A pedicle is a graft, isn't it?
The pedicle is the tube of flesh that is used to build up another part of the body. After 4 or 5 operations, Doug had managed to give him a new lip so that he could close his jaw, and he was able to many months later come and have a meal with us and eat normally with us, which was a tremendous triumph. It really was an achievement, because Doug Clifford had turned a chap whose life was really very precarious to a really useful member of society again. And he left our care to go to have new false teeth made in a town. We'd moved a long way by then, and there were people who could give him more teeth. That was really a very great achievement to be able to do that. One of the Chinese doctors in another area tried to do the same thing, but of course it wasn't successful because he wasn't careful enough about asepsis and so on, and it all went septic and all sloughed off. But this was really a great triumph. The Doug Clifford used the sewing cotton, the good old coat sewing cotton from my sewing bag for the stitches, and that was really my only contribution to it. But it was wonderful to be part of something like that.
I think I saw a photograph in your album about
this. Oh, yes.
Did I?
He went and had a photograph taken of himself after Doug had finished and presented it to us, which was very, very nice.
With a nice little message.
With a message on it, with thanks, yes. And he presented us with pheasants, which he shot, and things like that. It was really wonderful.
If I could ask you a little more about the International Peace Hospital. Why was it called that? What was international about it before you went?
Well, I think it had been started by Dr. Bethune, and I think there had been a slight international flavour to it when it started. Actually, when we went back to Yan'an later, we found that where we'd been working wasn't actually the International Peace Hospital as it had been. That was in quite a different valley. But anyway, we were told that's what it was, and it didn't make any difference at all, actually, because of the evacuation that had taken place before we got there during the autumn. And the hospital never really worked again in Yan'an from then, because although a few patients came back and we did a little bit of work, by March the military situation had changed so very much for the worse. Chiang Kai-shek, for prestige reasons more than anything, was obviously going to attack Yan'an itself. And so arrangements were gradually made to evacuate everyone and everything of any value, or to bury it, or destroy it, because they were not in a position to defend it against Chiang Kai-shek. It would have been a difficult place to defend, and it wouldn't have been worth the effort.
Yes, I must ask you a lot about that later on, Elizabeth. But if I could just ask you a few more questions about the hospital. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the tiers of wards.
Oh, yes, yes.
Did that create problems, sort of getting from one ward to the other?
Yes, you had to, you know, it was, they had to have little lamps to go about at night, and it was very much, it could be slippery in the winter, and in the rainy season it must have been very difficult.
How about lighting for operations as well in these caves?
Ah, now, we must have had a generator that produced electricity there. I think there were proper lights, proper Western theatre lights there. That was the last time we ever were able to use anything like that. I don't know how the surgeons managed, because, you know, usually they make such a fuss about having the absolutely correct lighting. But they had got proper theatre lights there, in the operating theatre there. Later, when we were in the villages, they managed with no artificial light whatsoever, and sometimes not even glass in the windows. The light was appalling, and also we had no proper operating tables, and so that you couldn't alter the height the patient was lying at. The surgeons had to get used to having everyone at just the height that the box they'd been able to find to use as a operating table was.
But this was rather more sophisticated.
Oh, yes, there was a proper operating table and everything. It was, well, it was like a cottage hospital or something like that in England, and not the standards were not very low.
What sort of cases were you treating there then?
Well, I remember there was an appendicectomy. I don't remember treating soldiers in Yunnan. But we realised that later we probably would have to, that would be our role. You see, when we got to Yunnan, we'd imagined that we'd be setting up teaching classes and a proper syllabus for nurses and aspiring doctors. And, of course, that never came into being. We got some language classes going, and I remember trying to... I used to teach some nursery rhymes, and I thought possibly in the distant future somebody might be amazed to find somebody in Yunnan singing Bar Bar Black Sheep or something like that, you see. But I also remember trying to teach them to tell the time in English, and I realised that some of them couldn't tell the time in Chinese because they came from such primitive backgrounds. And that made things quite difficult. Also, there was a dearth of interpreters, although we had two interpreters given to us. Yes, I haven't explained this, that in other parts of China, FAU makes their own arrangements for board and lodging and paid their own accommodation and so on. But when we were in the communist territories, they took full responsibility for providing our clothes and board and lodging paid for everything. With that, we accepted that we would go where they told us to go. And they considered that the drugs and so on that we'd brought in with us would pay for our expenses, which it didn't work out very well from their point of view, but they always treated us as honoured guests, and we were always given the best that was available and were treated with great courtesy and consideration.
You were saying about going back to the cases you were treating.
Oh, yes.
Were there many diseases that you were coping with in Yunnan itself? You know, we'll leave the marching part aside.
At that time, I don't remember there being a lot of diseases. Well, there were a lot of... there was typhus and so on, but we didn't meet it then. There obviously was a great deal of typhus in the hotter weather, but there were a great many lice. And of course, typhus is lice-borne. They tried to teach the local people as well as their own people how to help control lice. And I have a marvellous book written sort of with the minimum of text and very, very descriptive pictures that was distributed to the peasants, I suppose, as well as the party members to try and... get them to get rid of lice and to prevent typhus, and how to recognise it if it broke out.
How easy was that, you know, teaching such sort of primitive people?
Well, they had they were very short of paper to start with, so that the printing was pretty primitive, and it was difficult. It had to be very, very simple, because most of the local people would not be able to read. And so it would have to be done in picture form. And there were posters as well as these little books that I came across, trying to instill the beginnings of hygiene to the people, local people. And they were very particular about how their own arrangements of hygiene were arranged and so on.
Did you find that this was different from, say, the nationalist areas?
Oh, yes. There just was no care at all. And, of course, the Japanese had been extremely ruthless, too. If there was a outbreak of a waterborne disease, they would close wells and so that they couldn't be used. They didn't try and purify them. And they were very, very strict about that. Mind you, it was, in a way, it was a good thing, and the only thing you can do in those circumstances. But they didn't teach. They just acted for prevention.
So were you doing any teaching, any medical training, actually in Yan'an itself?
Well, really, we didn't get round to anything that was of any great value because for lack of people and for, you know, every week or every day almost, they would say the situation was changing and we'd wait and so on and things would be more settled later, but actually they didn't become any more settled.
Well, what were you actually doing yourself in Yan'an, you know, during these few months before you went off on the march?
Well, not very much, I'm afraid. I did help in the operating theatre and I went through what instruments and so on they had, and as I say, at every turn I was told, no, Dr. Bethune does it that way. But nevertheless, I hadn't much to criticise, but of course he had an American-Canadian background and I came from England, and I'd found very early on that a lot of things are a bit different. And, I'd found that, known that earlier. And so consequently, I didn't want to interfere with what was a reasonable system. And so a lot of we did find, we had a lot of time that we weren't really using very usefully, which was disappointing. It was all very interesting, but we didn't feel we were making much of a contribution. And it was also sad that we weren't going to be able to carry on as we'd expected, being a sort of nucleus of a teaching organisation, and that our work was going to be disrupted by a new outbreak of civil war. Because the feeling in the whole FAU was that things were now going to be on a peacetime basis, and plans were made to turn the Friends Ambulance Unit, which was a wartime organisation, into the Friends Service Unit, which was a peacetime organisation. And the families were being told that now they could live as families and it would be all right if you had brought children or had children. Lewis Hoskins, the chairman, brought one child with him, and his wife had another child while she was in Shanghai. Two other people had children in Shanghai. And I started one as well, you see, thinking everything was going to be straightforward, which, of course, about the worst time in history that I could have actually chosen to have a baby. But everything did work out all right, but it was a bit of a burden to the authorities, I felt. I was a bit ashamed of myself being a bit of an extra burden to them instead of being a help.
Were you actually pregnant in Yan'an itself?
It was sort of doubtful whether I was or not.
I must ask you a lot about that later on. But while we're still in Yan'an, this is before you leave in March, did the communists attempt to indoctrinate you at all?
Not at all, never. The interpreters would pass news of international interest onto us in a very helpful and sensible way. Hospital staff and other people we came in contact with would have self-criticism meetings and political indoctrination meetings, but we were never expected to attend. We weren't refused permission to attend if we wanted to, but of course they were conducted in Chinese.
Did you ever see them yourself?
Oh, yes, all very earnest, sitting around on their little bricks. And we saw the university, when I say sitting around on their little bricks, you'd see students walking around carrying a brick and probably a couple of pens in their outside pocket and a book. And they'd carry this brick round to sit on when there was a class. And you used to keep your brick, otherwise somebody'd pinch it and you wouldn't be able to find one.
Did you ever get any impression from the audiences, you know, the pupils at these sessions, whether they were genuinely interested or just putting up with this?
I think the majority of them really were interested, yes. I think, although sometimes they would complain, you know, that it was taking a lot of time, they really were interested. And they really were very frank, and things were very freely discussed.
Well, what do you think the main differences were between life for the Chinese in that area and in Hunan, you know, the area you had left?
Well, the actual area in Hunan is very, very primitive, and the production is very, very low. So nobody had a lot of anything. Food was extremely simple. The main staple diet is millet in that area, which actually is very tasty, has got more taste than rice. And but there is a certain amount of wheat grown, and they from that they make manto, which and noodles, which people don't seem to realise is what a large part of China produces, and they don't live on rice in the central plains in the north. They live on this manto, which is steamed bread, and noodles, which are made out of bread. In fact, Marco Polo took the idea of spaghetti and noodles back to Italy. So they're not they didn't start in Italy. That's the story. So occasionally we had wheat products, and but usually it was millet. And galangal is grown, which is sorghum millet. That was considered a garnish. And they grow a certain amount of Indian corn, maize. But the Americans looked at it and said, my goodness, that's the stuff we'd feed the pigs. Because, the production is so low. And they grow a little cotton, but the bushes are tiny. And, very, very small. And there's a little bit of wool from sheep. But their diet would be very sparse and very, very simple, with very little meat.
How about the sort of government, the influences of government in that area compared with the Hunan, which would have been the nationalist area, wouldn't it?
Yes. Of course, the situation was this was a rural situation, and in Hunan I'd lived mainly in an urban area. But things were were not at all stable in the nationalist areas. And if the army came through, they'd take everything. While you did feel in Shanxi and Shanxi that if the communists needed things, they would ask, and the peasants would be quite prepared to supply what they could because they knew they'd be reasonably recompensed.
Did you ever see ladies with bound feet?
Yes. That was in 46. And the older ladies did all have bound feet. Anyone under about 40 would not have bound feet, but people over 40 would have these tiny little bound feet. In fact, in a most isolated little village, I think I saw a lady with the smallest feet I'd ever seen. I have a photo somewhere. Yes.
How small would they have been?
Oh, about 7 inches long, I should think. Yes. Also, I've got an X-ray somewhere of a bound foot. And also, Margaret Stanley got a photo of somebody who'd taken her bandages off, and you could actually see the foot. I'd never seen one unbound, because usually they're very, very shy of taking the bandages off to show you, because the foot is crushed in such a way that the big toe makes the point of the foot, and the other toes are all curled up underneath the foot. It must be terribly painful while their feet are growing. And, of course, they get used to it, and when they walk, they take all the weight on their heels. So they're sort of stumping along. They look, they reminded me of cattle somehow. I don't know why. It seems very rude. Of course, it's meant to make them look dainty, and I really couldn't understand how they got that idea.
The fact that you didn't see anyone under 40 with bound feet, that sort of indicates that the nationalist policy was working.
Yes, well, of course, that goes back a long way. It goes back to Sun Yat-sen.
That's right.
And before the communists and the nationalists arose and divided, And it does show that laws in China were obeyed over the vast area, and that there must have been a very firm and efficient form of government way back, much earlier in the century. It's really quite remarkable. I suppose it indicates that the Chinese are used to taking authority from above.
How about the water situation? Did you have to be very careful with this?
Yes. Now, the Chinese know that unboiled water can cause illnesses, and except for a few isolated springs. And consequently, the Chinese never themselves drink unboiled water, and usually drink, well, nearly always drink it hot, or, you know, as tea, but they hadn't always got tea out there. And so we always did the same. We had tea and coffee we'd brought with us, and but it did run out, and we drank boiled water for months on end. But also water for washing and so on was often a problem. In Yunnan, I suppose there was adequate supplies with the river there, but it often had to be manhandled, they'd have animals with kegs on either side, and they'd fill them up, and the animals would bring them up to a central reservoir, or often there would be a well or a spring. The area is fairly well supplied with small springs and streams, but sometimes a spring will have dried up near a village, and they'd have to go 3 miles to get water, and several people would be their task all day to bring water up to the village. So water was used with a certain amount of respect, and of course the not much water was available except in the narrow valleys for irrigation of crops. The lowest soil is very fertile once you can irrigate it. And one of the marvellous things when we went back later, when we flew into Yunnan in the 70s, we saw these little round things on top of the hills, and I said, what are those? And then I found that they'd been able to dam some streams to produce electric power, which was then used to pump water to the top of the hills, where it could be used for irrigating the fields down the hills, and they were growing apples, and the ground was producing marvellous crops because they'd harnessed the local power and used it to produce more crops, irrigate. It was really absolutely splendid. And of course, if it's irrigated, the land doesn't blow away in the dust storms. It just improved the area tremendously.
Did you have any idea when you were in Yunnan itself about the position of women and whether or not this was changing in a communist
area? Oh, yes, in the communist... Women were quite equal. There was no feeling of a difference with men and women.
Would that have been very different from other areas in China?
Yes, I think so, yes, yes. Yes, it was... I suppose it was quite noticeable, really. Of course, we get used to it, but... there, women did seem to be, certainly in the party, were equal to men. And jolly well had to work hard, too. They weren't pandered to.
How about sort of marriageable age for women? You know, did you get any... I think you mentioned earlier there was some restriction on marriage.
Oh, yes, yes. They were not expected to marry until, I think, men were about 26 and women about 24.
Would that have been very different from other areas?
Because yes, I think so.
Of child brides.
I think so. I think in the other areas that there were, and even among the peasants, I think although there would be they would be married very young. But certainly in the party, they would not be expected to marry till they were about 27, in their late 20s.
With married couples, you know, was there any sort of law about having children?
There was no law, but it was not as it happened later. But nevertheless, they felt it was a great inconvenience to have children, and terminations of pregnancy were not unknown. And they certainly husband and wife are not always able to live together. They'd often be separated in their jobs over great distances.
The abortions, then, you know, this is what we're talking about, isn't it? Well, you know, how would they have been performed at that stage? Have you
Do you know, I didn't see them at that time. I think it would have been an ordinary curettage then. When we went back later, they'd had all sorts of much more sophisticated things, as sophisticated as anything in the West.
A curettage, is that a pretty basic
method? Oh, yes, yes. Well, I mean, it's what was done here at that time.
And how about relations between the sexes? You know, one gets the impression in the communist area that they were quite sort of pure, if you
yes,
like.
Yes, yes, I think on the whole they were very, yes.
Puritanical.
Yes, puritanical almost. Or very, well, unsexy, shall I say. I don't quite know how to express it. But, you know, the sex didn't make any difference on the whole.
How did you adapt to this life when you first went to China, you know, up to Yunnan, rather?
It's extraordinary how easy it was. And really, I mean, we were a strange group of people. I haven't mentioned Margaret Stanley. Oh, I did mention them, didn't I? I did explain about them coming, yes. Because we were all so different. And yet we seemed to fit together very well. I was fortunate, I suppose. I was married, which gave me a sort of bit more stability than the others. And really, we got on extremely well because, as I've said, it was very difficult to fill our time because of lack of materials and then being on the move all the time and not work, really, to fill all our time and our energies. So it was really amazing that we got on so well.
Yes. Did you have any recreations? You know, you have explained about the Christmas party the New Year party. Would these have been sort of Chinese affairs?
Those were Chinese affairs, yes. One thing we used to do, we used to find frozen waterfalls and slide down frozen waterfalls. That was terrific. We played cards a good deal, but only very, very simple games. One of the difficulties was lack of light in the night. While we were in Yunnan, we had petrol pressure lamps, which, of course, give a reasonable light. But once we left Yunnan, we'd have little dishes of oil with a little wick made out of a bit of twisted raw cotton, which give a minute amount of light, even compared with an ordinary candle. We had some candles with us, and I can remember we kept those for very special occasions. And we kept a little petrol to use in a petrol lamp the night David was born.